I mean, I was proud of what we did at the Journal. I was proud of all, you know, my colleagues at competing papers and broadcast stations, because the coverage was, I thought, even-handed and detailed and in-depth, so that you could understand what really happened. In retrospect, those, you know, 2001 through 2003, say, when the Iraq War started, is really maybe the last great gasp for daily newspapers in America. I mean, they did a great job, but by then, the business model that newspapers relied on for so long had really begun to break down. And now, of course, it's broken beyond repair. So, which doesn't mean bad things for journalism. I guess it could, but to me, as long as there's demand for a product, in this case, things I didn't know 5 seconds ago, or great stories that move me or make me laugh or make me think, make me act, that demand is greater than it's ever been. And as long as there's demand, some smart kid is going to figure out how to meet that demand and renew the model, but it's going to be different.
Before we talk more about that, and I do want to talk about that, I think the other thing about the coverage after 9/11, I don't think people really thought as much as they should have of how challenging that was for the journalists who covered that, because many of them, including yourself, I'm sure, this was your hometown that had been attacked. I mean, it was a very personal story.
It was, and now for me in particular, I was actually in Washington, and it was attacked too, but not to the level that New York was. But my colleagues at the Journal in New York at the time worked in the financial center there, and they were kitty-corner from the towers. And for months, you could literally look down from the Journal newsroom on the 8th floor right into Ground Zero. And I think of these people whenever I hear pundits lacerating the media, either from the left or the right, because they got out of subways, they got out of cabs, they got off of ferries, and they got their notebooks out, and they started reporting the story and did an amazing job. In retrospect, I'm sure they didn't think of this at the time. They risked their lives. One of my colleagues got on his bike and rode back into Ground Zero after the buildings had fallen to do some reporting. And I saw all of the emails, the files that were coming from New York that afternoon. It was just a wave, a huge wave of files, 30,000 words worth, mostly from New York, some from Washington and Pennsylvania. And it was an amazing experience. Terrible experience, but, you know, this is what you prepare for. This is why you're a journalist.
My memory is of all the broadcast journalists, many of whom were standing there covered in the dust and debris from the tower collapse.
It was not good for them. That was a very dangerous place to be.
But there they were, still calmly doing their job on air. It's incredible.
Yes.
Incredible. That's why news will survive, is because these events continue to happen. News continues to happen, and people want the story, of course.
They sure do. I can only speak for the Journal because I was there. So I assembled 3,000 of those 30,000 words into a story that ran on page one the next day. Well, today, if, God forbid, a 9/11 happened, all of those memos would have been cleaned up and put online one by one, one after another. We probably would have weaved them together into various lengths of stories. But we wouldn't be waiting, you know, 24 hours to tell people what was going on. And by the time, like by 7 o'clock that night, when my story was just going to the printer, all of that stuff would already be digested.
Is that good?
It is. I don't know if it's good or bad. It's the way it is. And if you don't adapt to the way it is, you will be left behind.
So the upside, of course, of many of these changes is that the information dissemination is enormous compared to what it used to be. And the audience is enormous compared to what it used to be. It's worldwide instead of local.
And it's also participatory. They don't just consume it and then write a letter to the editor, a weak letter. They consume it, and if they don't like it or they have something to add or anything, it's bam. You hear from them right away on Twitter or Facebook or email or whatever.
The barrier between journalist and audience is gone.
For the most part, yes.
So what's the downside of all this?
Well, one obvious one, and we saw it with the Newtown massacre, with the Boston Marathon bombings, and again with this Malaysian thing, is the rush to be first results in some pretty dubious pieces of news. And
a lot of crap.
Yeah, a lot of crap. And that's a good word for it. And, you know, you don't want your motto to be always first, frequently right. You want to be right. And I think you want to be right not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but also, you know, it's in your own self-interest, because smart people who look to news organizations of any site or websites, whatever they are, for information, want reliable information, especially if they're relying on it to make investment decisions or decide which college their kid wants to go to or kid should go to or buy a house. They don't want to be relying on people who get it wrong half the time, because it'll influence them.
Or if you're a family member of someone who's in that plane crash.
Right.
You mentioned the demise of newspapers. Is that true for every newspaper, do you think, or just the big name newspapers in terms of the short future they may have?
Well, the big ones, particularly the Journal and the New York Times, have had some success in getting people to pay for subscriptions.
The Journal was actually took the lead on that.
Right.
I mean, started
out. This was like in the late 90s. We were already doing that.
Right.
Not as aggressively in retrospect as we probably should have, but
more
it is
so
making some, it is getting some revenue from that part of the stream, and the Times is too. But you know, those are very big brands, and whether say the paper here, the Missoulian, can do that, I don't know if they are trying to do it, but I think that would be more challenging, because people can gravitate to all these other sources. You just go on Twitter and find out what happened. Now, you're not going to find out a lot on Twitter about what happened in Missoula and Butte and Bozeman and Helena, which may be, you know, again, kids, youngsters who see there's a need for that, figuring out ways to get those people what they want.
I know some journalists, and I'm sure you do too, Mr. Grewley, who have left the profession because they're unhappy with the changes and also feel like that too much is being asked of the reporter now, that the time they used to spend doing research for their stories and so on is now challenged because they have to be doing more online work and more video, more audio, more everything in the same amount of time. And they didn't like that, so they left.
Right. Well, I should say, and I'm a reporter. I've been an editor and a reporter, and I'm a reporter now, that since time immemorial, reporters have said they have too much to do and not enough time to do X, Y, and Z. Okay, so let's get that out of the way. But it is true that reporters today are being asked to do a lot of different things. And it's, again, it's up to these organizations, the editors, to figure out how to maximize the output. I think that's a more difficult question for the New York Times and Wall Street Journals of the world, just because they have a legacy. And there are certain things they did before, and people don't want to let go of those things. And some of them shouldn't be let go of, investigative stuff in particular. It'll be easier. Easy is probably not the right word, but simpler for smaller, more narrowly focused news organizations. Like some of the new websites that have come up that focus on environmental news or education news or politics, well, Politico and Ezra Klein's new thing, Vox. And I think more and more you're going to see this rather than having big grab bag news organizations that do everything, that they'll focus on one thing that they get really good at, really deep, and readers will gravitate to that and they'll be willing to pay because it's got value.
You said earlier, and I think I just want to reiterate this, something you said in an earlier interview as well, that, quote, the reporter's mission is as ever, tell people things they didn't know 5 seconds ago and tell them stories that make them think, laugh, debate, cry, and act. That's still our job.
It's still our job, and it's not only that, it's just what we do as human beings. I mean, telling stories to each other is as much a part of our lives as eating and sleeping. It's what we do all the time. You know, most of the stories we tell each other aren't newsworthy, so to speak. But people want to understand their world, and it's our job to try to help them as best we can by telling them things they didn't know, by taking them places they can't go or they wouldn't want to go, and telling them what's going on.
Well, I've been speaking with someone who's been telling us what's going on for many years and won a Pulitzer Prize for that, and that's Brian Greeley, who's a reporter for Bloomberg News. Mr. Greeley, such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you.